Researchers are working on some technologies that are designed to remove carbon from the atmosphere, and we'll be talking about this research today. To begin our program, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. In the studio with me, Gregory Nemeth, professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the UW-Madison. Greg Nemeth, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks, Larry.
Also with us today, Grishma Gadakota, who is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering. And she works out of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UW-Madison. Grishma, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Well, you're relatively new to the campus.
Yes, I'm 3 semesters old on this campus.
2 semesters old. Okay, but you've been doing a lot of work, and talk about the research that you are involved in.
Absolutely. So the overarching research theme of what we do relates to how can we produce energy and resources that we need while reducing environmental impact. Now, when we look around us, there's a lot of detrimental environmental impact as a result of rising CO2 emissions. So that was actually one of the things that motivates us to wake up every morning to do what it is that we do. So I'm actually a chemical engineer by training, but all my problems are in the environment. And then we look around us and we think about what we can do as engineers with the tools that we have and with the knowledge that we have to potentially utilize this really interesting molecule known as CO2, or even better, how do we store it?
How do we store it? Yeah. Well, Greg Nemeth, how do you figure into this?
Yeah. So I'm not an engineer. I'm in the School of Public Affairs. So I'm working on public policy. But there is a connection with the technology with the work I do, because the research I do is basically to answer this question: how can we design public policy to stimulate innovation in low carbon and clean energy technologies? So what I look at is what kind of policies would work. Do we need a price on carbon? Do we need to fund research? There's an array of other different policy mechanisms we can use. What's likely to work? What can we learn from other places? And what can we really put in place that would create incentives for engineers, for students, for companies, for investors to work on the technology and push it in the direction that would be helpful for the environment?
So that's pretty important, too. By the way, as you're listening into our two guests, you can join in with your questions or comments. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And so the technologies that we're kind of talking about today, and maybe to some extent the policies, certainly they focus on, I saw a term, negative emissions. What does that refer to? What the heck does that mean? Greg, you want to take that?
So I spent most of my work since I started grad school working on technologies that would stop the flow of emissions into the atmosphere. Clean energy technologies, things that would create the electricity that we need without harming the environment. But as we've gotten further along and the climate problem has gotten worse and worse, it's become more and more apparent, I think in the last 10 years, but especially in the last two, that just stopping the flow of emissions into the atmosphere is not sufficient. We're going to need to do other things. And part of it is just making our communities more resilient. But part of it is probably going to need, and maybe more than probably, is somehow remove CO2 that's already in the atmosphere and put it underground so it's not trapping heat anymore. So those are negative emissions.
Yeah, okay. And that's what you're up to, Grishma?
In a way, yes. In fact, when I started out doing this kind of work about closer to 10 years ago, there was a lot of interest in putting in what they call carbon capture and storage technologies on coal-fired power plants. And in these 10 years, we've seen shale gas come on board. Mm-hmm. We've seen that penetrating the market increasingly. So now there's been a lot of talk about reducing CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere because now we're burning a cleaner fuel like methane. But that is actually not the entire story, because not only do we need to burn so-called cleaner fuels, we also need to figure out how we can remove what CO2 we have in the atmosphere and how we can put it away in a safe manner. And that is actually becoming increasingly important. So the whole aspects of not just developing clean technologies, but also how we remove the CO2, thinking of it as a contaminant in the atmosphere, is becoming increasingly important. And that is how negative emissions technologies fits into the picture.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned methane. Vernon Boyd has a comment on that or a question. Vern, hi. Yeah.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
I used to believe in CO2 theory, but I go on the internet and I punch in atmospheric methane, and atmospheric methane generated by farming is the number one greenhouse gas, far higher than CO2.
Yeah, comment?
Vernon, you're right. It's stronger than CO2 in terms of the amount of heat that methane traps, so on the order of 30 times stronger than CO2. There's a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere than there is methane, so in a way, it's a bigger problem. The CO2 is trapping more heat than methane, but, you know, per ton of methane, methane's much stronger. So you're right. And as we get serious about reducing CO2, and if we don't get serious about agriculture and other sources of methane, methane's going to become a bigger and bigger issue. So it's not something we can ignore, and it's a powerful greenhouse gas. And maybe more optimistically, because it's so strong, we could get some better near-term impacts instead of in terms of less damage to the climate in the near term by working on methane. So it's certainly an area that's in need of focus.
And I think there's probably all areas are in need, including getting that carbon out of the air out of our environment that's already there and sequestering it, getting rid of it. Rich emailed to say that there's nothing better at removing and sequestering carbon than a tree. And he talked about reforestation efforts should be a major part of the solution to climate change. What do you think of that, Grishma?
Well, that's actually very true. So more than 10 to 15 years ago, there was a very interesting article that came out, two articles that came out by professors at Princeton University, Steve Pakala and his... Steve Pakala, I think, was the main author on that paper. And basically, they talked about how you need a portfolio-type approach to addressing this problem. So this problem is so large in magnitude that it isn't a one-solution approach that we can take. Reforestation is important, but it is still one of the aspects that we need in this portfolio of options. So we need to be doing what we can, where we can. We need to be deploying technologies that are developed by engineers. We need to harness nature's technologies, which include being able to grow plants efficiently. And we need to be able to do all of this in a balanced manner.
And so that's why we've got, you know, the Energy Institute and the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. I mean, you're looking at a whole host of different kinds of research projects that are going on, for sure. Well, talk a little bit more, and again, you can join in, by the way, if you have a question or comment for our guests. The number 1-800-642-1234, and you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. It's, you know, that when I think about getting carbon out, I think about trees. I don't think about man-made ways that we can do it, so... Grishma, what are you working on?
We're working on a couple of different approaches. One involves actually reducing the amount of water that we use in recovering hydrocarbons from the subsurface environments and actually potentially think about using more CO2. Now, I put on my engineer's hat, and for a moment, I forget that CO2 is a bad molecule. And I just think that this is something that's available to me for very cheap, so why don't I use it? And turns out that there is a large scope for using CO2 for a wide range of applications. But then you put that in the context of the fact that it is a bad molecule in its ability to impact a lot of detrimental effects on the environment. And then we start thinking about, okay, what is the permanence of putting this molecule away? So for several years, people have worked on geologic storage of CO2. So how can you actually put CO2 away in geologic environments? Now we're increasingly pushing towards embedding carbon in our built environment. Is there some way that we can actually incorporate some of the CO2 molecules into the buildings around us, into the pavements around us, into the world around us, in different products, if you would? So I think that is increasingly getting traction, but at the same time, you take one more step back and you think about the scalability of all these different options. So there's technology development happening on one side, and then there's a scalability aspect of it too. So we need to be able to balance both of them.
I'm trying to imagine a process that would involve something with the buildings that are currently existing. that could, you know, do you paint something on all the buildings, or
how does it work?
Yeah.
Well, you're asking an engineer. So oftentimes when we cure buildings, we use water to cure buildings. There is actually a company based out of New Jersey, you know, Solidio Technologies, and now they're actually using CO2 to cure their buildings instead. So what happens is they actually have their own proprietary mix of cement, and then when you actually use CO2 to cure the cementitious materials, the CO2 goes in, reacts with that material, and actually results in a material that's of much higher strength. So that's actually one way you could actually put CO2 in the built environment.
Well, that's pretty cool.
It is actually really neat.
I like that. Oh, man. Tom in Black River Falls, let's give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hi, sir. Yes, I worked for a lot of environmental groups over the years. I'm an older guy now, charging on down. And we used to get disturbed when there was no room at the lakes or the public places. There's only one solution for all this. The population has to decrease. Period. That is all there is to it. The breeding has to stop. They have to come up with something for sterilization. This cannot continue with the pollution and the poison. The population has to drop.
Well, I don't know about that. Greg, let me give you a chance to comment.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that, you know, I do in my energy class in the fall. And we look at what are the sources of increasing environmental damage, especially on energy and also on climate change. And, you know, there's a model that came out about 40 years ago of breaking down to the problem into three factors. One is population. So more people, more environmental damage. A second is called affluence. So the richer people get, the more they consume and the more environmental impact they have. And then the third part is technology. So as you get better and better technology, you have less environmental impact for the amount of energy service or economic growth that you want. So basically, there's two things that are making the problem worse, people getting richer and more people, and one thing that's making the problem better, which is better technology. And so, you know, we're slowing population growth, but still, yeah, we're 7.5 billion people in the world, and that's probably going to grow to 9 or so over the next couple of decades. So it's certainly harder to do it with 7.5 billion people than it is with 9 billion people. But I think the bigger, much bigger challenge is that of those 9 billion people, there's 6 or 7 billion of them that are aspiring to the lifestyles that we have, which are much higher incomes than they have right now, and probably including transportation and using much more energy and moving around a lot more like we do now. So I think the bigger challenge is, how do we accommodate the growth that everybody wants to grow in a sustainable way and become wealthier like we've got, and we want to continue to increase our economy as well. So to me, the way you do that to accommodate a growing population and a population that aspires to have more energy services is to really double down on technology and have better choices, better technology, less expensive technology. So I can see the population issues is one that makes the problem worse, but we're not going to take care of the problem by slowing population growth or even in a big way reducing it. We really need to work on the way we extract energy to get the things that we want.
And that's where Grishma and others like her come in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Larry. I mean, that brings up a really important point in that when we actually see where CO2 emissions are actually headed, the majority of the CO2 emissions are actually coming from India and China and some of the growing parts of the world. Now, we could say that people are a problem, but at the same time, people could be a solution. And when we actually go into some of the smaller towns and we look at the way people who are not connected to the grid are utilizing solar panels, coming up with new ways of harnessing alternative energy sources. In a way, some of those solutions may be smaller, but if you can take inspiration from that and perhaps scale it up, maybe we have lessons that we can learn. So what this calls for is effectively a pooling of energy, or energy solutions, if you would, from all different parts of the world. We have a lot to learn. So population control may be harder to do from where I am, but being able to pool knowledge about energy resources and solutions related to that is something that I could do. So I think there's two ways of looking at the same problem.
Wait, let's take some more calls here. Tim in Fall Creek has something for us. Let's go there.
Two questions for you.
Sure.
most fossil fuel is basically carbon, is my understanding. Is there any way to break the carbon free from CO2 and reuse it as a fuel? And then the second question is, what happens if you run, you know, car exhaust or big power plant exhaust through water? Does it capture any of that carbon? Could that be used as that byproduct be used in some other way? I don't know, animal feed or plant food or whatever. Of course, I don't have any sort of degree in this sort of stuff. I just figure, you know, I know water makes a great filter.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Tim. Grishma, let's turn to you for some comment.
So, Tim, you're absolutely right. So there's a lot of carbon in fossil fuels, and that's actually one of the reasons why we even mine fossil fuels. So through a process which is known as combustion, we actually take the carbon that's present in these fossil fuels, react that carbon with oxygen. So we produce CO2 and we produce energy. Now, a lot of smoke that comes out of the stack gas, if you've ever looked at a power plant, has a lot of CO2 and water that actually, or steam, if you would, that actually comes out. So now this relates to your second question of, can we actually do something with the CO2 that we're producing? So it turns out that CO2 is a very, very stable molecule. And in a way that actually adds difficulties in terms of doing some of the neat chemistries that we can implement with it. And because it's a stable molecule, and effectively if you want to upcycle it back into making it reusable as another fossil fuel, now you're trying to take the CO2 and convert that into a carbon molecule that is bonded to other hydrogen. So you actually do need to put some energy in order to get that reaction going. And now the question becomes, where is that energy going to come from? It makes sense if it comes from some renewable source like solar. So there are a lot of different pathways that a number of folks are working. So there are electrochemical pathways, as people call them, thermochemical pathways, as people call them, of taking CO2 and converting that into fuels, or even products, for example. Now, in a country where, for example, I think it's some of the Nordic countries where there's a lot of renewable energy, there's a lot of interest in actually taking the CO2 and converting into fuels. So there's a lot of leadership in being able to take CO2 and convert it into fuels, and a lot of chemistry in those parts of the world. Now, the second question relates, no, I think your third question relates to if we actually take this CO2 stream or this water bearing CO2 stream, can we do something with it? Well, it turns out that it's basically carbonic acid. It's a weak acid. So if we can use that weak acid in some kind of application, that would be great. But more often than not, it's kind of a hassle. So what folks like us do is we actually develop materials so we can separate the water from the CO2. And so now we have a pure stream of CO2 that we can start playing around with and start doing some interesting chemistries with.
Yeah, interesting. We're talking today about negative emissions, among other things, with our two guests. Greg Nemeth is a professor in the La Falla School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Grishma Gadakota is an assistant professor in civil and environmental engineering at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Union Theater with the woodwind quintet Imani Winds, performing the program Old Made New, February 1st at 7:30, lecture at 6, uniontheater.wisc.edu. WPR connects you to the people in Wisconsin and around the world. You hear many perspectives and civil conversations every day, and you may even learn a few things along the way. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful conversations and the latest news. Thanks for listening.
We're looking at different ways to remove carbon from the atmosphere and what can we do with it with our two guests today. Greg Nemeth from the La Falla School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and Grishma Gadakota, assistant professor in civil and environmental engineering at UW. Callers online. We'll get a couple of callers, but there's a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rold in La Crosse, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on some work that I've been doing for about 25 years with trees and buildings and sustainable forestry, as well as trying to sequester and carbonate cities. As you may know, there's a large movement to create larger buildings with timber and what's called mass timber. And that's an effort not only to make buildings more sustainable, but also to really carbonate cities, use the things that are less producing of carbon, such as wood versus concrete and steel. Our business, my business I started, did the Festival Foods in downtown Madison with ash trees from the city of Madison that were going to get chipped up and repurposed that way. But so the question goes twofold. Is one, doing more intensive, really the plants are excellent at converting carbon into fuels and fiber that we can make cities out of and food, which obviously we currently do, but we don't do woody agriculture. So that's kind of that portfolio piece, is that we need to attack this on all sides, and plants are definitely a huge tool that we can use that are already solved a lot of the challenges and can provide a lot of the benefits of fuel, fiber, and food. Are you actively involved in carbonating cities in terms of the use of wood? And then also woody agriculture, permaculture, such as hazelnut to replace corn and soybeans, and also sequester carbon into soils using their root systems.
Yeah.
I'd like to address some of those issues.
All right. Thanks, Roald, for calling. Greg, let's turn to you.
Sure, yeah. I just make two points on that good point that Roald made. One is that, yeah, it would make a really big difference if when we build or expand cities and build infrastructure, today a lot of what we're using are the two most greenhouse gas intensive activities that humans do. One is making cement, which is used for concrete, and the other is making steel. And both of those together are releasing tremendous amounts of CO2. And so if you could at least do some of those activities with sustainable forestry and wood products, increasingly look viable and sustainable, not just environmentally sustainable, but that will last a long time for a building to survive. And then are also appealing to work in or to live in. So that seems to have a lot of potential, and it would be a big change and an important one as well. So having more carbon kind of sequestered in cities seems very appealing. And then second, on food, that's certainly an angle that I think a lot of people working on climate change have maybe not focused on as much. They've been focused maybe more on things like steel and cement that are obviously, and coal that are obviously carbon intensive. But agriculture is as well. And a lot of that comes down to our diets. And so people changing to diets that are maybe healthy for them, that are pleasurable to eat, but that also have less impact on the environment. That's been shown, especially with some papers in the last year, to have, you know, a similar scale of impact as increasing the efficiency of automobiles and things like that. So people's lifestyle choices could make a really big difference on some of these impacts as well.
And I would just mention that the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, is doing a lot of research, if I'm not mistaken, Greg, on plants.
Right, and sustainable biofuels and how to take advantage of photosynthesis and use the energy from it without creating environmental impacts, and offset some of the things we do with fossil fuels today, whether it's chemicals or fuels. So that looks really, really promising, and a lot of potential for that science to advance.
And thanks again, Ro. Let's go to Tom in Madison next. Tom, hello.
Hi, thank you. Concerning the new fluid that's used in heat pumps, which is HFC-134A, I've found that I can... Well, I have shut down my furnace and shut down my water heater, so I'm using no natural gas, and using that same fluid, I can run a small Freon turbine to make all my electricity right from the heat in the air with a small shoebox-sized generator, and I believe that unless there's a problem with HFC-134A that within 5 to 10 years we'll be able to shut down probably one power plant per week just using that coolant. And so if you could tell me what's the deal with that new chlorine-free refrigerant. Thank you.
All right. And I'm not sure that either Greg or Grishma. Grishma, are you familiar with this at all?
Well, I can't really speak to Freon, but I can certainly talk about where the future of energy is actually headed and how Freon might potentially fit into that. One of the questions that I often ask my students is if they know how much of the energy that we get is from the subsurface environments. And it's actually more than 82%. And there's an enormous amount of infrastructure around that. There's refineries around that. Our cars run on that. There's a lot associated with that infrastructure. So when we introduce alternative fluids, such as what you've mentioned, I'm sure there is a place for them, perhaps in a localized context, but I'm not entirely sure how that would fit into the bigger picture of energy use and energy infrastructure of this country. That's pretty much all I can say at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Tom, thanks for calling. And Michael in Oconomowoc, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi. I have been to a few grazing conferences around Wisconsin and the Midwest, and I've seen a few hour-long presentations where people pretty much go through the math how management-intensive grazing is actually banking more carbon than emitting. And with agriculture being at such a focus point on this of this conversation, I'm just wondering about changing the ways that we raise beef and lamb and all these methane-emitting products, and instead, grazing them intensively, rotationally, and be banking more carbon than emitting.
Greg, I'm going to turn to you. A comment there?
Yeah, I mean, without going into the grazing, which I'm not expert on and wouldn't have much to say, but what I do know from looking at these, a survey of all the methods of removing CO2 from the atmosphere, storing carbon in soils has very large potential, as large as some of these chemical processes that we might talk about, and maybe as large as forests, and without some of the trade-offs that might be involved. So if you can do things like cover crops and low-till farming, you can retain soil moisture and you can retain carbon in the soil and potentially not damage yields and not have some of the negative impacts that even some apparently benign things like expanding forests might actually create, such as creating competition for food. So, sorry to not speak directly to the grazing question you're talking about, but I think the potential for storing more carbon in soil is hugely underappreciated, and so I'm glad that you raised it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Sullivan in Green Bay, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi. I had two questions, actually. One, I know that you guys just made the point of steel being very carbon emitting, but doesn't the manufacturing of steel inherently use carbon?
Yeah, Grishma, we'll keep you there, Sullivan. But Grishma, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, absolutely. So cement and steel manufacturing companies are major sources of carbon. In fact, there's a company which is known as Baotou Steel in China. They're based out of Inner Mongolia, and they're actually trying to do something about taking a lot of their waste, which is known as steel slag. It's very rich in calcium and magnesium, and reacting that with their own CO2 emissions to produce calcium and magnesium carbonate. So absolutely, this is something the steel manufacturing companies are thinking about. In fact, some of them are actually trying to do something about this. Now, I see another follow-up questions about whether airplanes can be designed to use solar. So now there's been a lot of talk about decarbonizing the electricity grid, which is feasible and which is actually being done. But then there's also been talk about decarbonizing the transportation sector. So when we're talking about using solar on airplanes, effectively we're talking about decarbonizing the transportation sector. Now, one of the things that I heard at a conference was that how would you handle it if your airplane failed because of some inefficient fuel or some faulty fuel in midair? You wouldn't want that.
No.
So for that reason, there is still an element of being, I would say, risk averse in terms of experimenting with jet fuel. Decarbonizing jet fuel might be a challenge. Can we harness solar power in the long run? Maybe there might be different ways of doing that. But for now, at least in the near foreseeable future, it's going to be hard to imagine a world where we don't have jet fuel powering our airplanes.
So it kind of is like the automobiles that are hybrid automobiles. It's running on a battery, but you still need some gas in there.
Kind of like that.
Kind of like that, anyway. There you go, Sullivan. Thank you very much for calling. Let's take a call from Shaney in New Richmond. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling. I want to say that there's a gentleman that called earlier, and he really made quite a prominent suggestion about decreasing the human population. And your response was very gentle, and you came up with a lot of wonderful, wonderful ideas on how to necessarily not maybe go to that route. Really, that is the basic thing that we do need to do. But on the other hand, these wonderful suggestions that you guys came up with and that the other callers have come up with are impressive, and they're wonderful to listen to, and they've given me a lot of hope. At the same time, if our species was willing to step up and do these things to begin with, there's only a very few of us that care enough to do these things.
Yeah. Well, Greg, I want to turn to you for a comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to take this issue seriously because it's a lot bigger problem, these environmental problems today with 7.5 billion people than they were 200 years ago with, say, a billion people. So certainly it makes it harder with more people. But where we are now, we need to reduce our CO2 emissions by something like 90% over the next 3 decades. And so I guess for me, if the 3 ways to do that are 1, reduce people by 90%, or 2, reduce our incomes by 90%, or 3, boost technology so that we can have 90% more efficient, I guess the math is wrong, about 10 times more efficient energy production there, I'd go for technology. I just feel like it's something that we've actually proven that we're pretty good at. And technology always comes with unintended consequences, and we'll have to manage those as well. But just compared to the alternatives of reducing people's incomes or reducing the number of people, I feel like we've got a better chance with technology. But the final thing I'd say is, I completely agree. Population growth has slowed down a lot in the last 3 decades, and the projections of where we would be by 2050 are down to like 9 billion instead of 12 or 13 or 14 billion. And so if we can do what we can do to make sure we stay on a track for 9 billion instead of 12 or 14, that really is important. So I guess I would say let's not take our focus away from what we've done to make sure population is sustainable. But I just think we need other avenues to really work, at least seem more appealing to me. But it certainly is a root cause of where we are.
Here's one from the political side, sort of. Deborah emailed to ask your thoughts on the newly introduced Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, a bipartisan bill introduced in the House last week. Greg, are you familiar with it?
Broadly, I mean, the basic idea is that, one way to make some of the transformations we're talking about and get some of these technologies moving that we're thinking about is to put a price on some of the damage that occurs when we burn coal or we drive cars or make steel or make cement and all the other things we've kind of referenced here. So that bill would be to put a fee on the carbon that's in fuels, and that it would basically be a way of paying a price. And that would create incentives for people to use more sustainable fuels, more efficient end-use devices, similar to what the caller made before, make a stronger incentive to build buildings out of wood instead of concrete and steel. So that would be it seems appealing. That's something people have talked about doing for many years, and it's something that we've done in other technologies, such as reducing sulfur dioxide, and that's been very effective. The thing that seems to be a problem with it is a lot of times it's portrayed as just extracting more taxes from people and increasing the tax burden. I guess this bill is kind of interesting in that it tries to avoid that by returning the revenues that are raised from that fee to offset people's income taxes. And so that's one way of, you know, just shifting production away from carbon-intensive technology without, you know, penalizing people for it. So we'll see how it goes, but it's a promising step.
Carmen emailed to say she recently heard of a type of concrete, Grishma, that she thinks it's called ECC or engineered cementitious composite, I believe is what it is. It's made by increasing the amount of seashell material in the mix. Makes the concrete able to heal cracks as they become exposed to air or water, thus improving the strength and durability of whatever you're building. Is this the case? Is this what you were talking about earlier? If not, is this the case with this particular material? Would it also help trap more carbon inside the concrete?
So I would say the prerequisite for actually trapping CO2 in pore spaces is actually via a physical route or a chemical route. So a physical route is when you have a pore space that is really just right enough to hold that CO2 molecule in place. The other route is where the CO2 molecule can actually react with the material itself. So then it gets embedded in the form of a carbonate as opposed to carbon dioxide. So those are two routes of actually storing CO2. Now, the physical route is a less permanent route. The chemical route is more permanent. So in this area of research, there have been many, many materials that have been proposed and that people are working on. Some of these we're developing in our lab as well. But some variation of physical-chemical interactions, if you would. And now, I haven't taken a very close look at the material properties of ECC, as it's called, and I would be rather keen on taking a look at it. But if it has the right chemistry and if it has the right morphology, if you would, then maybe we can make it work for CO2. But right off the bat, I don't have enough information to say.
And on that note, we are out of time. Boy, the time flew by. I want to thank you both very much. Hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Yeah,
I think it'd be wonderful to have you back. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Greg Nemeth is professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Grishma Gadakota is an assistant professor in environmental engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as well. Great to have them along, and we'll get them back. We'll do this again. It was an interesting little conversation there. You know what we almost always talk about every time we get up in the morning? What's the weather like? And, you know, once a month, the weather guys come by to even spend more time talking about the weather. And they're up next here on the Ideas Network.